CliffCentral.com.
I like it. Now, Bali and I were just talking about how Bruno Mars, it's hard to identify what his actual sound is because he samples so much stuff that he transcends any kind of time period or any specific genre, huh? It's amazing. All right, that's called Chunky. The one thing that I am delighted about today is that BBC Planet Earth 2 is scheduled to premiere very, very soon. I'll tell you those dates and times and everything else. DSTV Channel 184, that's BBC Earth. It's coming right up. I think it's on Sunday, the 5th of February. Now, we're lucky to have in the country, at the moment, the guy who produced and directed this. It's an incredible production. If you've seen little clips of it, and remember that one went viral with
The iguana and the snakes.
Everybody's talking about that. Everybody's talking about the snow leopard. There are lots of other things, but I guarantee you every minute of this show will blow your mind. That's how the previous one, I've still got it on DVD. I actually pulled it off the shelf the other day and watched it just to kind of take a big deep breath about where we're at in history, because we think about human stuff most of the time, right? We're consumed by our own health, our money, our relationships, our urban environment, and we forget that we're part of this ecosystem, and we forget about all the things that we're interrelated and correlated to. And it just drives me mad sometimes when I see how disconnected we've become from all the other things that are alive, that make the planet as interesting as it is. And that's the stuff that makes Earth interesting, because let's face it, what's useful about planet Earth as opposed to Jupiter, Mars, or Saturn? We've got living things. That's all it is. And I've got to say that I think that the BBC are very, very smart to spend money on shows like this, because everybody loves them. Remember, it drew the last one, Planet Earth, the first one, drew an audience of over 1 billion people all over the world. You know that? Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see the figures for Planet Earth 2 then, because those will be astounding.
An unprecedented view of life on the planet Earth. Now 10 years on, with all the advances that we've made in technology and filming and all the rest of it. Dr. Freddie DeVos is here with us this morning. Let me give you the proper introduction so that you can at least feel as important as this show that you've made for all of us. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, very nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
And great to have you here. I've been waxing lyrical about how much I love the idea of the show and what I've seen of it. But I'm sure it's going to be even more impressive when I eventually do see it. These shows, I was talking about this with my buddy yesterday. These shows must take such a long time and such a huge amount of patience and painstaking effort to put together.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent nearly 4 years on this series. And there are other people like Justin who produced the Mountains episode. He was on the series for 5 years. So that's 5 years, each of us producers, making just 1 hour of television. So it's a huge dedicated effort. And then there's a core team of around 20 people that are spending that amount of time, and then lots and lots of other freelancers that come in to help out during those 4 or 5 year period.
Doesn't it infuriate you that the Kardashians just walk around and the cameras just film, and then they put that into some sloppy show once a week and they get ratings? Doesn't that drive you mad? Here you are for 5 years.
Well, we have a really long shelf life. I mean, like you say, you've still got the Planet Earth 1 DVD. So that's 10 years ago, but people are still watching that same show that was made 10 years ago. And when you're talking about, you know, audience figures, like you said, for Planet Earth 1, where it's getting to vast number of countries around the world and huge numbers of people are seeing it, and they're seeing it time and time again over year after year after year, then you think, well, maybe it's having quite a big impact.
No, it's absolutely worth it. But it is incredible that in 2017, where we can make entire TV shows in a split second almost, you could film things and virtually have them stream live to an audience without any production, without any artistic flair, without any real strategy about where it's going, and yet your show and the like of it, and there aren't a lot of shows that are like this, is painstaking about how this is the goal, this is the purpose, this is where we're going, this is what we want to film, this is what we've got, this is what we still need to get, this is how many cameramen have to be out there, this is how many different angles and shots we need to get, this is how we get the animal to either cooperate or not. And you have, you know, light conditions that are not perfect. You have weather conditions that are not perfect. There's so much that can go wrong.
Yeah, so we visited over 40 countries to film this series, and we had around 2,000 days in the field where we were following the animals and trying to capture the behavior, how they behave naturally, understanding the animal behavior, getting to know those particular animals within that population, and then getting in the right spot, like you say, with the right light and weather conditions. And but, you know, that's a lot of work, but we're really amazed by the response that we've had so far. Because in England, it's been, you know, a bigger success than we could have dreamed of. There's more than half the population of England have viewed the series. And also, we're having a big impact on the younger generation, which is great. So we had higher viewing figures within the younger generation, so 16 to 35-year-olds, 16 to 24-year-olds, those bands, than X Factor was having. So X Factor, this huge show that's normally extremely popular, it's live TV, and yet a lot of young people were tuning in to learn about the natural world because it is so remarkable and it is so special. And potentially because it's under threat in so many places at the moment. And so it's an important... What these landmark series like Planet Earth do is they give a little portrait of the planet at that moment in time. And they say, remember how special the natural world is, how these wildernesses are wonderful places to witness.
How's technology changed since the last one? Were you involved in the last one at all?
I came into the BBC to work on Frozen Planet. So straight after Planet Earth. So it was with exactly the same team as... Well, a lot of the team members from Planet Earth moved on to Frozen Planet, and we did.
So how much has changed in terms of how you record stuff? You know, I was thinking of just very simple things like, you know, before we didn't have means of digital storage, and I'm not talking about, you know, Planet Earth, but before that even, we used to have, you had tape. Had to record to tape. Now at least you have tiny little devices you can store gigs and gigs on.
Yeah.
Which does help, and it makes it a lot less complicated in some ways. And there's some things that technology can do. Maybe you can tell us what some of those are, but there are also things that technology can never replicate, that technology doesn't change a damn thing about. You still have to sit there and wait for the monkey to climb along the branch and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So we call that long lens behavior capturing. That's when a camera operator is sitting down and waiting for hours on end, days on end, for particular behaviors to happen, and they're capturing it right at the end of their long lens. And that you can't go without. But there are certain techniques that have really moved on leaps and bounds. So in Planet Earth 1, we use the Cineflex, which is a stabilized camera attached to a helicopter, and you're flying, and it gives a really godlike perspective to the planet, this aerial view where you look down on the different habitats and you can pick out the animals and follow them from the helicopter. And on Planet Earth 2, we thought, let's go for a more intimate feel, because now that same stabilization technology has been brought down in size.
So to drones.
To drones, but also to handheld stabilized rigs, so that we're taking the camera off the tripod and we're able to walk with the animals. It can take a lot longer. So I produced the Cities episode. And in the
magnificent.
It's a very different place to work than the wilderness. But one advantage is that some of the animals are very habituated to humans. So we could walk, say, amongst whole troops of monkeys, right in amongst them with a stabilized camera, and see their lives as if we're one of them through their eyes with these stabilized camera rigs. And I think that gave a much more intimate and organic feel to the camera work than we've been able to achieve before.
It is cool, though, that you can attach a recording device of some kind to some of these vehicles, to some of these new technologies, and get into places that you might not have been able to get into before. Very small places, very, very far, high, low, deep, wet, dark. It's amazing how much we can reach now that we weren't able to reach except by our own immediate and intimate experience before.
Yeah, for us, low light technology, you touched on that then, yeah. is huge because so much of animal behavior happens at night when we can't see it.
Yeah.
And in the Cities film, it's different to Planet Earth 1 because we were thinking, how can we make this series still feel classic and follow on from that first series, which was so well received, but also freshen it up, bring something yeah. new and different. And looking at the cities or the urban environment as a habitat for animals to live in is a new idea, relatively speaking. And a lot of animals that inhabit our cities are coming out at night. And there was one sequence where I was filming hyenas in Hara in Ethiopia. Yes. These are spotted hyenas.
Right.
The second largest land predator in Africa after the lion. I mean, I know a lot of your audience will have seen them. A lot of your audience will know how fearsome they can be.
But not in an urban, we don't have them in our urban environments here.
No. And there's this one, well, I think you may do every now and again.
Well, probably. We prefer not to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, Mabali used to have a much, much younger sister. She was taken away by hyenas once. It's a very sore point.
It's a sore point. Let's not go into that.
Well, I know. It's a joking point, but it does happen. Hyenas have been known to pick yeah. off small children. And this is something that we showed, that there's this one city in Ethiopia where the locals welcome in the hyenas into the city. And I had to see this for myself because I heard this story and I thought, this is extraordinary. I mean, I've once been on a walking safari in Uganda and I was surrounded by these two hyenas that were just circling and circling and getting closer and closer. Oof. And I asked the guide who had a gun, do you have any bullets for that gun? And he said no, which I suspected.
Oh my God.
So at that point, we made a dash for it and we ran back to camp, which was, I don't know, about 500 meters away or so. But it was a terrifying experience because they were on our scent and they were investigating. And yet
Did they chase you?
They were circling and circling and circling. And when we ran, we didn't look back. We just ran.
You just wanted to survive. Good Lord.
And then in Ethiopia, I was there. Because I'd heard that this is a city where spotted hyenas are welcomed into the cities. I mean, the local inhabitants believe that they not only clean up the streets of the bones that the butchers put out, but they also clean up the streets of the bad spirits each time they cackle and howl. And I was out there. I was on my own. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a really dark, narrow, cobbled street. And I saw 8 hyenas turn the corner and start walking towards me. And I thought, okay, there's nowhere to go here. And they just walked straight towards me and straight past me. And 2 of them brushed my leg because it was such a narrow, cobbled street. And at that point, you know, if they'd turned on me for their dinner, then there's nothing I could have done. There's no one else around. There's nothing.
Would have said at the end of Planet Earth 2. Yeah, poor old Freddy.
In loving memory of.
It's great to know him. Jesus. Unfortunately, during the filming of this, he died. He was eaten by hyenas.
But that's the remarkable thing, is that that didn't happen. And just a few days later, a few nights later, I was surrounded by over 100 hyenas. And there were 2 clans having a fight on the outskirts of the city. And this is getting back to the point. And with a really low light camera, I was able to pick up what was happening, which was these 2 hyena clans battling in right on the outskirts of the city. So only a small amount of light. And I was able to capture that. This was on the recce. We also captured it on the main filming trip. And what those hyenas are doing is that they're fighting for access to the city because they can't lay down their territorial boundaries within the city because they can't scent mark there because it's all cobblestone. There's no bushes and anything. And they can't make their scrubs on dig out the sand because it's cobbled streets.
Sure.
So they work out who's dominant in the city by, like West Side Story, like gangs going outside to a specific place. They have a fight. They work out who's dominant. And then that clan gets more access to the city. And that was, I mean, remarkable because we had the technology to be able to cover that story like we never would have done before. But I think far more remarkable in that sense that these are wild animals. And we could see that when these 2 clans were fighting. And there are 100 of them fighting all around my feet and the camera operator's feet when we were filming it.
God.
But we didn't have any fear because for the last 400 years at least, humans have been living side by side with these you know, what are often massively vilified animals in the streets of Harrow. And it's a completely peaceful pact. And that's, I think, where some of Planet Earth 2 can be really revelatory, is that we're always trying to bring new stories. And I think stories that also just change your thinking of what's in the natural world and what the natural world's
like. Isn't it amazing that there's this overlapping area now where humans and animals are coexisting again for the first time in thousands of years, perhaps, in places like that. Mm. And if you look at things like pigeons in cities and that kind of thing, that finally we're coming to some kind of symbiosis again.
I think that's very much at the core of the city's film, is to say there are some places, not that many, where that symbiosis is happening. So I just want to say one more thing about this.
Of course, it's always on our terms. It's not on the animals' terms, but they've managed to evolve the ability to coexist with us.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Where we are not the object of either their predation or they're not the object of our predation, but we can both carry on with our business.
So we filmed peregrine falcons in New York City. They're the fastest animal on our planet. And they are doing not so well in their natural habitat. A lot of pesticides get into their food chain and they die. But in cities around the world, they're doing incredibly well. Now, certain types
abundant
of cities,
food.
They've got pigeons.
No natural
predators.
No natural difficulties in terms of, you know, habitat being lost or any of that stuff, because they can live anywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they need cliff edges to live on. So New York City
skyscrapers.
Has over 700 skyscrapers. So they live on the skyscrapers, and they've got their favorite prey, which are pigeons, right down on the streets below. And the highest concentration of peregrine falcons nesting anywhere in the world is in New York City. So we're in Manhattan on the tops of skyscrapers bird watching, which is a strange thing to go to New York for. But that's an amazing story whereby they're recolonizing cities. Certain animals are recolonizing cities. We don't even know they're there. A lot of people don't know they're there.
I've never seen a peregrine falcon in New York.
Yeah, right. And so many people don't know that. And yet it's all happening above our heads. You know, the action is happening. I was there. I was aware of it. And we saw several hunts happening from the streets and on top of these roofs of skyscrapers. And it's really dramatic behavior. But that's a situation where, you know, we're not. They're actually, in a sense, a bit of a service, because people are concerned about the pigeon numbers. But they're not really making a big dent into the pigeon numbers, because there are so many pigeons. But no one's bothered by the peregrines. In fact, people are becoming proud of the animals in their cities. And that's a wonderful thing.
Can we talk about you for a second? You actually did your PhD on baboons in Namibia, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Now, baboons are fascinating animals. Mm. And you must have spent a lot of time with them. How long were you there for?
So I was in the one park in Namibia called Salvis Leopard Nature Park for 3 seasons. So 3 years where I was there, 7 or 8 months, just following the baboons from dawn till dusk.
It's always interesting to me. I don't particularly like zoos. I'm sure you don't either. But people are fascinated by primates because they're most like us. They're our closest relatives. Baboons don't get as much attention as chimpanzees. Maybe they're not as smart. Who knows? Mm-hmm. Perhaps also they look a little more fearsome and less anthropomorphic than chimps do. But baboons are very widespread in our country, and in places like Cape Town, they also are starting to come into the cities and starting to play a part in that ecology in ways that are not always very welcomed.
Yeah.
But what kinds of things did you discover about baboons while you were out there doing your PhD?
So me and my team were looking at social foraging. So we were trying to say, okay, when you're a baboon, if you live in a group, that's great. There are lots of eyes to look out for the leopards that are coming to hunt you. But then when you find a patch of food in a tree, then you've got to compete with all your other group members for that food. But what affiliations do baboons make within their groups? And we were looking, is it that you want to eat near your family, or do you eat within the same sex? You know, is it the males and the females, or do you eat within the same age group?
Were you looking for, is there a fascination in this particular part of their behavior because it might give us clues as to how we used to behave?
That's interesting. It wasn't so much related to that. It's related to how baboons are relating to the environment that they live in. These are clumped resources. These are desert baboons that I was studying. So they're patches of food that are just isolated from each other. And how do you get along? And that does say something about human behavior, how we live in society, how we function as groups. So this, the main finding was that who you groom, it's all the grooming affiliations. That's who shows you tolerance when you're facing competition. It's who you're nice to. It's not who you're, it's not so important how you're related or whether it's a female and you're a male or whether it's a different age. The key thing was how much time you've spent grooming them and how much time they've spent grooming you. And that was a really, well, I mean, that's quite a heartwarming result in a sense.
It is, but it's also fascinating because it does tell you a little bit about how societies develop, and especially primate societies, and we're one of those. And I suppose whoever you're nice to in society will have your back when times are tough for you.
That's right.
It does in some way relate to the way that humans behave.
Absolutely. Now, baboons get a bit of a bad rep in this country and other countries. And I know that because I've been to Cape Town, and they're very different. They're the same species of baboons that I studied in Namibia.
Chacma baboons.
Chacma baboons. But the Chacma baboons that I work with didn't know humans, and we spent 8 months from dawn till dusk every single day habituating them. So they'd sort of alarm call at 150 meters, and eventually you're walking within a meter of the big alpha males. You know, these males that are 35 kilos, enormous canine teeth. Everyone
very
knows
strong,
them. Yeah. Incredibly strong, potentially hugely dangerous. We're not interacting with them. They're viewing us a little bit like they might view a horse. Okay, that's a big, powerful, but benign creature, you know? and then spending years, I mean, months and months and months each year in the company of baboons, you just recognize what extraordinarily special animals they are. They're very bright. They can be very rough. They can be very tender. They've got all shades of a lot of human characteristics, you know, we can see within them. But it's all with the situation, say, of baboons in Cape Town and vervet monkeys in Durban. It's all about looking at the long, long-term picture. So in India, we filmed macaques in Jaipur and we filmed langurs in Jodhpur. And the langurs in Jodhpur have been there for generation upon generation, and they're fed by the locals. And there's real harmony between the people and the langurs. Langurs do have a different character to baboons. They're less aggressive. The macaques are more similar to the baboons. But still, they're very peaceful because they know what the rules of engagement are. And so they can live side by side in the city totally peacefully because they know that's okay and that's okay. And the people of Jodhpur know if we put food out there, yeah,
the langurs are going to take it.
So we have to be careful. But they love having the langurs there. And I know that there are some people that, in South Africa, you're lucky because in your gardens, it's rich with wildlife. You've got amazing bird life in your trees. You've got wonderful plants in the gardens. But obviously you can see some animals as really destructive. The elephants can be very destructive in rural areas. The baboons can be really destructive in. But it's all about thinking, what is the future of cities? Because now more than half of us live in the urban environment. That's more than 4 billion people. So do we want to keep that tie to the natural world in the urban environment? And I hope that the answer is yes.
I hope so too. And I do think that part of the reason that we're so fascinated with primates is also the reason that we're scared of them, is because we see intelligence, and I think we see power, and we see some things that make us aware of the dark side of our own behavior a lot of the time. And that's probably why people are so keen to get them out.
Yeah.
In the case of baboons in Cape Town, get them out of where, you know, civilization is.
Yeah, and that's throughout the natural world. You know, dolphins are thought of as very sweet animals, but they have a dark side as well. I mean, that's in the natural world. And we don't want to, you know, anthropomorphize too much. You know, these are wild creatures. They are their own species.
You also spent some time in Equatorial Guinea with regard to sort of studying the movement of people and bush meat and that kind of thing. And that's a scary thing too, because we are we're doing a huge amount of damage to the wildlife in those areas because people are looking for protein.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's an important thing, an important point you made there. So that was a study on the bushmeat trade, and I spent 6 months living with the hunters right in the forest. I mean, like a day's drive from anywhere with electricity. So we hadn't, you know, there was just one bumpy road, and it was an amazing experience. But those people that I was living with are extremely poor, and their diet is nutritionally poor as well. So the men looking to provide for their families, the hunters that were, I mean, all the hunters I worked with were men, were looking to provide, you know, money and protein. That's what they did. And traditionally, the women were more in the fields providing the other crops, like the peanut crops and other things like that. And so it was, I couldn't criticize them for what they were doing. You know, I was there when two chimpanzees were hunted, and the hunters were ecstatic because that came to, you know, a salary that would pay for 2 months of living for their families. But obviously I was incredibly sad to see chimpanzees being taken from the forest.
What does chimpanzee taste like? Did you ask them?
Yeah. Chimpanzee is really sought after. It's a sort of often thought of as a delicacy. Delicacies around the world can often be because of rarity as opposed to taste.
Right.
So there may be that going on. But it's a sad situation because we can find protein from other sources. So the study was saying, look, I mean, Equatorial Guinea is an interesting situation. It's got the third highest oil reserves in Africa after Nigeria and Angola. It's got a huge amount of money, and a very small population. If that money was shared more equally amongst the population, then you could get fish farms, which use up a small area of land and have a huge amount of protein in fish in there. You can give different crops that yield protein.
Yeah.
There's lots of alternatives.
Well, unfortunately, Teodoro Obiang Nguema is more interested in running a family business than he is looking after the people of his country.
It doesn't spread. The money doesn't spread far. And that's a real shame because the potential for making pristine virgin rainforest in that country, you know, protecting it, allowing sustainable hunting to happen within it. So you can sustainably hunt bush pig, you can sustainably hunt bush rat, all kinds of species can be. But the primates and the long-lived large elephants and pangolins, you know, they're in huge decline. And in 15 years, we may not see any more forest elephants in Africa. The forest elephants, not the savannah elephants.
You talk like someone who really, this is a lifelong passion. It's something that you wouldn't be doing if you didn't love. How did this start for you?
Well,
where were you born? How did you come into contact with such a love for nature?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think when I was, when I was 6 years old, I described what I wanted to do to someone, and they said, oh, you want to be a zoologist? A six-year-old doesn't know what a zoologist is. So it took me a few years. I think I was 10 when I looked up what zoologist meant. And then I said, yeah, I want to study animal behavior. And it's unusual. I mean, sometimes people have fads and change, but it's unusual. It just stayed with me. I grew up in the countryside in France and then moved to the Middle East and spent a lot of time swimming around the corals in the Middle East, and then moved back to England.
So then I should have said that you're Freddy Devas.
Oh, no, I'm Devas, yeah. I'm British, but it is a French name. You're right. Okay.
So I don't pronounce the S. I was worried
about
that.
No, that's right. No, Devas.
Devas.
Devas is right, okay. Yeah. It's English pronunciation.
All right, so you're born in France. You go to places like Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, Qatar. Qatar was where I grew up. So I grew up in a lot of places. My father's an architect. My parents moved 23 times by the age of 21. So I went to a lot of different countries growing up. And I guess I experienced a lot of the natural world because that's passionate in my parents. And I know that in South Africa, there's a lot of people that are lucky enough to go to the extraordinary nature reserves you have here.
We have so much on our doorstep, and there's some people who obviously don't. And that's fine. Not everybody has to be interested, but for you, this is something that you wouldn't have done anything else.
No, and that's interestingly why I was really keen to make the cities episode for Planet Earth 2. And that's because There are so many studies now that show that urban living can be quite stressful for us, you know. And views of greenery calm us down. They lower our heart rate and they make us feel at peace. And that helps with our happiness and our health. So there are lots of studies that show that if a hospital bed has a window with a view of greenery versus a window with no view of greenery, they have faster recovery rates where they can see greenery. Schools have better attendance where the windows have views of greenery and better grades. And job retention is better when offices have views of greenery. So it's this thing that if we invite the wildlife into our cities, if we welcome it, if we green our cities, then they might be much happier and healthier places for us to inhabit.
It'll improve our lives.
Mm.
You did Meerkat Manor.
Yeah.
Now, that was very, very popular. I remember watching that. Did you ever see it, Ben?
Yeah, I used to love that show.
Beautiful show. I mean, every one of them had a name.
Yeah.
They were all, it was like a soap opera, except with meerkats.
Yeah. Well, that was all filmed in South Africa, near Upington.
How long did that take you?
I spent 6 months filming the meerkats, just for one season. That was a heavenly job. I mean, honestly, getting up before dawn every day to follow meerkats around. They have such interesting lives. I mean, which you saw from Meerkat Manor. Yeah. And then you break for lunch because it's incredibly hot and the meerkats don't tend to be doing much. And then you go back out for the afternoon and see these beautiful sunsets every day. It's, you know, it's like therapy. It's amazing. It's just, it's such a wonderful experience to
but
be
But there
out
must
the
have been days, just like with Planet Earth 2, there must have been days where you didn't get anything.
Yeah.
Now, do you feel, because if I felt after 2 or 3 days in a row that I hadn't got what I wanted, I would be very frustrated.
Mm.
I would start getting annoyed with myself. Mm. I'd start losing interest in the subject matter because you're not getting what you want.
Yeah.
How do you build the patience into this?
Yeah, that's important. I mean, meerkats, they're doing funny, hilarious things every half hour, so it's right. Fine. But when we're filming the leopards in Mumbai,
mm.
there are over 35 leopards in a small patch in Mumbai. It's the highest concentration of leopards anywhere in the world.
Really? And yeah. they're in amongst these people?
Yeah. So they're, it's an extraordinary story. They live in a forested area within the heart of Mumbai, and they head out into the city to hunt in the nighttime.
And what do they eat?
Well, mainly animals brought in by humans. A lot of feral dogs.
Dogs.
And pigs and other animals like that, that some of the people are keeping in, you know, little patches within the city. But a lot of dogs actually make up about 25% of their diet. It's the cat dog, but the tables have turned. It's no longer the dog chasing the cat. But that was extraordinary. I mean, when we went out there to film there, we thought, if we just get one shot of a leopard walking left to right within the city, that's going to be extraordinary enough. We were hoping to capture a hunt, and I guess you'll have to see. But we were very lucky with what we captured. But that was all about spending night after night, I mean, awake all night, scanning the horizon for looking for where the leopards might be, moving position.
Despite this high concentration of these animals in this little place.
Yeah.
You struggled that hard.
Well, they're so elusive. I mean, leopards know how to stick to the shadows, and they know, you know, how to keep out of man's view, because that's how such a large predator is able to inhabit a city, a metropolis. I mean, 21 million people living in Mumbai, or over 20 million. It's extraordinary. But that cameraman, Gordon Buchanan, I mean, showed enormous patience, because night after night after night, he would not see anything. But then when he did see it, it was so special. It keeps the hope alive. And then actually what he got over the course of the month that he was there was really remarkable behavior.
You've got to give credit to the BBC for putting the money into this, because it's expensive to do.
Mm.
It takes a lot of time. Mm. You have to hire really smart people, talented people, because there's an art to all of this, which is unspeakably beautiful. Every part of it is curated in terms of its visual impact as much as it is the subject matter. Mm-hmm. And this is not something that's easy to do in television in 2017. And budgets are just not available. It really is one of the crowning glories of any kind of public broadcaster that they're able to anywhere in the world, dedicate a large amount of money to doing something like this, even if they hadn't known, and they probably didn't, that it would be the success that it has become. It quite easily could not have, but it would still be a very, very good record of where we're at. As you said, a snapshot of the earth right now.
And I think we have a lot of thanks to give to David Attenborough, because he is not only a presenter of wildlife shows, but he was controller of BBC Two, the second largest channel in the BBC, for a number of years. And he's integrated in that world. And what he knows is that every child is fascinated by animals. Every single child is fascinated by animals and their natural world. And that remains alive in so many of us. I mean, perhaps in all of us to a certain extent, to different extents. And so it's television that moves us and feels important, because we're tapping back in to our connection with something that is so special.
I want to get to David Attenborough in a moment or two, but, you know, Mabali and Ben and I often talk about how these animals sometimes get upset with humans and take out their own anger and frustration on us.
As they should.
Yeah, I mean, we hear about, in India, for example, we hear about these elephants that just decide to, you know, storm into the city and just destroy whatever they can, because they're just pissed off with the people coming into their space and getting in the way. Do you find a lot of examples of where the animals actually teach the people something, and where the people have learned to be more respectful of the animals than perhaps in places where just, you know, people are stronger and mightier and they just exert their influence, and the animals eventually just go, this is not a place that we can cohabit in?
I think the cities is the best example of that. I mean, for the other episodes,
what other, you've talked islands, about the peregrines, these leopards, which is fascinating in Mumbai, the monkeys in Jodhpur, and where else?
Oh, we filmed bowerbirds in Australia. That's a brilliantly comic story, because these are long-lived birds, very intelligent birds. They can grow, you know, they can live to 25 years.
They build these very elaborate nests.
Yeah, exactly. And they're different to nests. They're bowers. They're just there as a status symbol. Yeah. Just say, look what I built. Come to me. It's the males showing off to the females. And in Australia, what they love in the cities is they love to collect tat, like bling, to decorate their bowers, because it's the certain colors that they're looking for.
So they're like basketball players.
All right. And so they love shiny objects, they love colorful objects, and they put them all in specific places around the bower. Then when the female comes down, it's their stage on which to do a dance. So they dance around it and they show off the different objects, and it's really, really fascinating. And I think that, I mean, it's one example of where animals are, the humor of those animals, they're so engaging. People love them. And they love having those birds within their cities, and they become emblematic of those cities. But they enjoy how individual each bower is. So no two bowers are the same. You can get bowers that are just a few hundred meters apart, and yet those two males have a totally different palette. I mean, they're artists, and I believe this genuinely. You know, they do things totally different. And that's something that we respect in our culture, that diversity. And that's something we see in the natural world as well, which is important to recognize, you know. No two animals are identical. Obviously, when you're looking at ants, they have, you know, their mission, and they can be very similar. But intelligent animals like bowerbirds, primates, they're different.
Well, you've seen some amazing stuff. I can imagine that that you've traveled to places that none of us will ever go to, that you've been around animals that none of us will ever encounter. Those are very, very special things. But David Attenborough's really seen and done it all.
Yeah.
I mean, this man has been wading through tropical jungles and marshes and swamps. He's been on high peaks in the middle of the snow. And he's 90-something years old now and keeps going.
So he's 90 years old. And just after his birthday, I filmed him right at the top of the Shard. So the Shard is the tallest building in Western Europe. It's in London. And we were talking about the future of urban wildlife. And so you take a lift up most of the stories, you'd imagine, and then you've got to climb 9 stories up some steps and then another story up this ladder through a little opening. This is a 90-year-old man. So we allowed lots of time, and we had a doctor on call, and he's a national treasure. You know,
sure, of course, nothing, you can't have anything happen to David Attenborough.
Happen. And he got up there and walked up there in a flash, leaving lots of us behind. I mean, he's a remarkable man. I mean, he's so knowledgeable about the natural world. It's incredibly impressive. But what I think is more impressive than all of that is his integrity. He's never done advertising. He's never done endorsements or advertising. He's never said, what my words are going to say is so that you buy this packet of crisps or this
ever.
Product.
Not a single thing.
Because he's saying what he says is all about what it's all about passing on the knowledge about the natural world. And he has real integrity about that. So he's not only charismatic and incredibly bright and sharp and witty, and but he cares enormously about the natural world, but he holds his integrity very close and very strongly, which is great.
What a compliment to him. Did you get to spend more time with him, or was that the only interaction?
No, and then, you know, during the record of the script, you obviously talk through the script with him, and he goes back and forth about your ideas, his ideas. You know, he molds it into his own words, and he questions it hard and really brings a lot of the academic rigor to the script which is fantastic. He also lightens the mood, brings in humor. It's fantastic. And in the com record, I mean, he's hilarious. He's a very witty man. There's a bit where we say, oh, David, actually, we'd like to change that line. Can we say that? You know, would that be possible? And he cracks a joke. He says, you know, I can't remember the exact words, but, you know, it'll be hard to do it, but I can do it. But he makes a lot of people laugh still. At 90 years old, he's still a hugely remarkable man.
Wow. It's incredible that someone has also maintained such a brand. He's been sort of the animal man to a lot of people, and the plant guy, and the person who knows more about geography and about zoology and about what kind of animal lives around what kind of environment, and how they breed and where they go in the winter and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, coming back to that point about the BBC putting a lot of money into
and he just he knows that stuff. If you had a conversation with him, he would be able to tell you not just the things that you hear in scripted television shows, but a whole lot more.
Yeah, huge amount more. He's a serious authority on things like fossils and bowerbirds, and also his general knowledge about the natural world is, you know.
So it's quite intimidating.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You need to know your subject matter. It's not, you don't talk to David in frivolous terms. You need to, you know, it's important to know what, to know your foundation of what you're talking about. Absolutely, because he's putting his voice to it, and that's important. And he's, you know, you see National Geographic, you see Discovery Channel, they also put some money into wildlife shows, and that's great. But he's the one that really grew the industry of wildlife filmmaking to what it is today, and we have a lot to thank for that.
I'm still fascinated by the cities, and I think that'll probably be one of my favorite episodes when it eventually comes around, because as you say, there's this fascination about humans and animals interacting in an urban environment in a way that, you know, we almost have the home ground then advantage, but in some ways these animals have managed to overcome all of the supposed problems, turn it into an environment where they can thrive, and many of them do. But you've been to amazing places outside of cities too. It sounds a bit twee, but are there some places that you never want to go back to? Because either you had an incredible experience there and any subsequent experience would be a paltry comparison, or that you want to go back to a place over and over again because it's just the most intimate, incredible, powerful and moving experience. Where in the world do you find where are you most alive? I mean, what is the place that you just love to be and around the animals that you are there?
I think that's a really interesting question, because having worked on a series like Frozen Planet, where we went to the Arctic and the Antarctic, that's real, true wildernesses. And when you're in the Antarctic, you're surrounded by thousands, hundreds of thousands of naive animals They don't know what a human is. They don't know if it's a threat. They just see you as something strange of a certain size. So, you know, I went to one place in Antarctica, in sub-Antarctic island called South Georgia. There's a bay there where you're looking at between 300 and 500,000 king penguins, beautiful penguins. And then you walk through the beach and there are these 4 to 5 ton elephant seal males, these bulls. They're enormous, and fur seals and albatrosses. And then you're right up behind the beach. There are these 3,000 meter peaks. And it's the most stunning place. And to spend time there with virtually, you know, just your team, no other humans there at all, just the filming team, surrounded by wildlife, is really extraordinary. And wildlife that isn't running away from you at all. They're curious. The penguins come up, peck the tripods, peck your legs, try and work out what you are. And it's, you know, that's something that really stays with you. But equally, my trips to Hara in Ethiopia, where I saw a man feeding hyenas, spotted hyenas, wild hyenas by hand, and he's a fifth generation man. I saw children walking the streets where there are hyenas walking the streets. So people and hyenas crossing paths in the streets all the time. And that's a tradition that's gone over 400 years that people have welcomed the hyenas into the streets. That was really mind blowing. And so it's not that you need to go to Antarctica to see extraordinary wildlife experiences. You can have them in cities. And I think that's important, because even the little moments of watching the birds come to your bird feeder in your backyard can feel so special, because you can learn about the different individuals. You can see, you know, which males got your garden as their territory, keeping the other males out, trying to woo the females in. You know, all that kind of stuff is just, it's wonderful to watch, in my opinion.
I agree with you. I can't wait to see the show. I think it's going to be extraordinary in every way. The first one I loved, and there's no reason why I wouldn't love this. The trailer was enough to grab anyone's attention. And I can't wait to see cities. I think it's going to be spectacular. Thank you so much for coming to see us. It's a pleasure to meet you, Freddie. And I wish you luck. I hope you'll spend much more time here in South Africa.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Gareth.
Are you planning any other projects now that this one is in the can?
We came out to South Africa and we came a couple of days early so we could go straight to Polanisburg, and we had an amazing time there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's lovely. And we're going back there, and then we're going to Lesotho. Just a few days either side of the trip just to experience.
Are there any creatures or places that you really want to get onto film that you haven't yet?
Oh.
Or that you'd love to meet that you haven't yet?
A million.
Okay,
a million.
But what's at the top of your list? I mean, I've got a list of places I want to visit in the world, and this year I've decided on a top three. What are yours? Come on.
The film I'm working on at the moment is about the Antarctic. It'll come out in 3 years' time. I love going back there. There are places in the Antarctic I want to go back to.
There are places in the Antarctic that no human being has ever been in.
Yeah. I mean, most of Antarctica.
I mean, it's fascinating because underneath all that ice and snow is a very large continent.
Mm. Absolutely.
We probably don't know the half of what's going on down there.
Yeah. I think that's, I mean, that there's Galapagos Islands. I think that's where the snakes and iguana sequence was filmed, which is terrifying and captivating at the same time. I mean, that's a wildlife hotspot. That's an amazing place. I'd love to be able to go there one day.
Yeah, well, not only because of the animals, but because of what it meant for Darwin.
Right.
And what it meant for us starting to figure out things like finch beaks and basic evolution. I mean, the survival of, the species. It's amazing. All right. I could talk to you all day about this. I really could. This is fascinating. Planet Earth 2, it comes to South Africa on the 5th of February, 2017, premieres on that Sunday, the 5th of February at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. BBC Earth, which is DSTV channel 184. Make sure you don't miss it. Thank you, Dr. Freddie DeVos, for coming in to speak to us this morning. Producer and director of some parts of Planet Earth 2.
Great. Thank
Amazing.
You very much.
What a privilege to work on a show like that, huh?
Yeah, it was very special.
Amazing. All right, I'm delighted. This is great. It's good to meet you too. All right, everybody, that's a wrap on this morning. We'll be back tomorrow between 6 and 9. Here's what you need to know in the news. may not waste anybody's time, right? We've all got things to do, people to see, places to go. So here it is. Don't forget, tomorrow Justice Malala joins us and John Robbie will be in from 8 to 9. Donald Trump promised free healthcare for all recently. That was a typo from his speechwriter, though. Turns out he was meant to say free healthcare for all that voted for him. To claim this right, all Americans have to go onto social media and admit that they voted for Donald Trump. And hey presto, free healthcare. Everybody else, go to Crooked Hillary. An Australian political party is looking to ban burqas in the state of Queensland. That's mostly because Aussie men are tired of getting into trouble for making politically incorrect jokes about their fashion statements. So with the burqa gone, they can make general female slurs rather than getting mixed up in religious tension as well. And finally, AFCON 2017 reaches round two of the pool stage today. Locally, in the ratings, it hasn't captured the imagination of South African viewers very much. The latest numbers aren't good. Some reports showing that midweek PSL games get more views and fears that the final numbers will be so low that they may even register fewer viewers than Super Rugby. That would be terrible. We will see you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.